You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. We hope you'll consider making a donation to us to help us continue to bring you these podcasts. Just go to our website and click on Donate. Thank you. I'm sitting here in the studio with Sonia Clark, who has a new exhibit at the Walters Art Museum called Loose Strands and Tight Knots. Sonia Clark is chair of the Department of Craft and Material Studies at Virginia Commonwealth, the University of School for the Arts in Richmond, and she joins us here today to talk about her work. It's good to meet you. Good to have you here.
And my pleasure to be here, Mark. Nice to join you.
It's interesting. I don't know where to begin this, but I could begin with your work, which is probably a good place to start.
Mm-hmm.
And I was fascinated by the idea of working with hair, mm-hmm. with human hair, with your hair.
Mm-hmm. Actually, what's interesting about the show is that a lot of people have been saying, oh, you have a solo show at the Walters. And I said, actually, it's not a solo show.
Right.
It's that the other artists in the show are no longer living.
You do that on purpose, did you?
I didn't knock them off. I'm just saying they're no longer living. And so there's artwork that the curator, Tasha Grantham, has brought together out of the collection, out of the Walters collection, to sort of set up a conversation between my contemporary artwork and practices and antiquities, frankly. Mm-hmm. And so they're wonderful pieces that are made out of hair from the Victorian era. So certainly this is not a new art form. And to me, that's a sort of natural thing. I was trained as a textile artist or a fiber artist, and I often think, what was the first fiber art? And of course, that's hairstyling. And it's something that we're all familiar with.
You know, that's hair is fiber, right?
Hair is fiber.
I never thought
of it
as fiber
art.
Right.
And as soon as we are manipulating it, then we're manipulating that fiber. And as soon as we're manipulating it for aesthetic purposes, then it's art. And so it is the first fiber art form, and that means that in one sense, and as much as it's such a ubiquitous art form, sometimes it's easy to overlook. And so the idea of using hair, one of the reasons I do it, is that I'm trying to communicate something through my artwork. And mm-hmm. I always feel like artwork can fall into this sort of negative place where people go, I don't get it, it's beyond me. And I want to use a language that is familiar, use a vocabulary that is familiar to other people. Almost everybody, yourself included, combed their hair or at least ran their fingers through
something.
Their hair today.
Right.
Something. And that means that already they understand something about the material that I'm using. Now, there are all sorts of other sort of visceral reactions that people have to disembodied hair, which is another sort of notion. Maybe we can talk about that a little later.
But I get the sense that people have been working with hair for a long time.
For a long time.
But you seem to have a kind of, I'd like to talk a bit about your philosophical view of hair.
Mm.
I mean, and what it means beyond just taking strands of your hair that might come out when you're combing it and collecting it and using it.
Yeah. And actually, I've done a recent collection. For those of you who can't see me, my afro used to be twice as big as it is, and now it's a little shorn because I had to make an art piece.
But you shore your hair for your art.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I cut it off because I had a piece that I had to make, and I said, it'll grow back. but the thing about hair is that I think it's almost impossible to, in this country, talk about issues of hair without getting into issues of race. And so I think that there's a little bit of that kind of dialogue that's in the work, because though I have multiple heritages, I do identify as an African-American person.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, just to go back to some of the work that's in the museum right now, is that this idea of using hair in Europe sort of hit its height in the Victorian era. So that's when Queen Victoria was around, of course. And she was very proud of her Scottish heritage, and we share that in common because through my mom's side, my mom's maiden name is McCarty, and we have a crest and a tartan and all the good works.
Oh, you can wear a tartan too, can you?
And I could. But I don't think people would look at me and guess about the Scottish heritage. So, you know, so kind of an interesting thing to have a hair piece that I've made out of my clearly African-heritaged mm-hmm. hair next to a piece that was commissioned for Queen Victoria, and know that we both have this interest in hair. The other thing about hair is that it can be sort of this divide, you know, this idea of what constitutes cultural notions of beauty. And I made a piece once, I was sharing it with in a slide talk, and it's an image of Abraham Lincoln that I've sewn an afro on. It's not in the show, by the way. So it's a $5 bill, and it's called Afro Abe. And he has this big afro. And people think that's really amusing. And it is intended, honestly. It's intended to be amusing. But there is this other part of it that I realized, why is that so funny? Because it's not so strange for a black woman to walk down the street with her hair straightened. People don't find that funny, right? And the reason that they don't find it funny is that it has something to do with sort of cultural notions of what is deemed to be normative beauty. And in this culture, normative beauty often ends up being dominant culture beauty, right? So putting an afro on Abe is a little weird because that's not dominant culture beauty, at least not in hair, right?
Right.
Whereas putting straight hair on a black woman, not funny. That's normal.
Seen as normal.
Yeah. And so those kinds of things become a kind of interesting thing. So there's a sort of aspect that has to do with what happens culturally in the Americas and with those of us who came over through forced migration that makes hair and hair politics and hygiene and beauty complicated.
And how do you think your work speaks to that?
Well, I think that there's something about it's pretty clear that it's not European hair that's being used. And so already someone can guess something about the maker. I also think that there's something, if I can sort of attend to my own use of my own hair, is that I grew up with a Jamaican mother, Trinidadian father, but a Jamaican mother who was like, if we cut your hair, we burn it, we bury it, we don't just let it go.
Because someone else could take that hair and use it and do something to you.
That's right. Absolutely right.
Right,
and
right.
So, you know, to go to that place of discomfort as an artist and say, I'm using my own hair to make artworks that are, and here's the kicker, for sale. When I'm talking about, you know, this legacy of history and all of that and how that complicates issues of beauty in this nation, then I'm making artwork out of my own hair and selling it. Are you allowed to sell things? I'm selling my own body into the art market. Is that right? And you know, my mother certainly would not approve of that. But there are several things I do that she does not approve of. But but just thinking about beauty as a commodity, right? Or something that's antithetical to normative beauty as a commodity. So I think that those kinds of things. I think there's something about disembodied hair. There's a difference between running your hands through the hair of a lover and a hair in a sink that you don't know who it belongs to. You know, as soon as it's disembodied, there's a kind of ick factor, frankly.
Right.
And it makes for this sort of visceral, uncomfortable place. And I don't hope to agitate with the work, but I do hope to provoke. And so provoke can take you to provocative, hopefully. And I'm hoping that the work does a little bit of that. And also by putting it next to these other objects that are the type that people are used to seeing in the Walters, it allows a kind of space, the loose strands, if you will, from the title, and perhaps the tight knots, how to bring two objects that seem disparate in some way and bringing them together.
I'm curious, when this exhibit was first created by the curator with your work, my assumption is that did she come up with the idea of pairing your work?
She had, she knew that she had an opportunity to be to do a special curatorial project at the Walters, and she knew that the Walters had some interest in bringing living artists into the museum. And to draw from the collection seems like a natural way of bridging the collection with the work. She also knows that my personal interest is not to take lightly any object of material culture. I mean, I've been making a whole body of work just about combs because I think, what do these mean? What are they about? What are the stories that have to do with combs? Same thing with a disembodied hair. It sort of led me down this path.
Well, hair is attached to combs.
Yes, exactly.
Combs are attached
to
hair.
Exactly.
So what do you think about the interplay of your art with the Buddhist art, with Renaissance Italian art, with Victorian art, all having to do with hair, some hair that is hundreds of years old and some hair that is probably just a year or two old that belongs
that's
to
right,
you.
That's right.
So, I mean, what do you think of that interplay?
Well, I think ultimately the work is about this notion of heritage, how we're all connected. There's something about, even when I'm talking about the sort of difference between another culture's notions of beauty, that to put those in juxtaposition, it talks something about our humanity. So it's being in a group show with multiple voices. The challenge for me is that I can't speak to those other artists to ask them about their making. We can just go on the history.
But you can imagine them, can't you?
I can imagine them.
What do you imagine?
Well, the thing is that everything in that show is made by a craft person. And I'm the chair of a craft department.
Right.
So, you know, I'm looking at this beautiful claw of Queen Victoria's with this, I believe it's a ruby that's inset in it. Just
right.
This beautiful thing that might also cause a sort of ick factor, but it really had to do with hunting and that sort of thing. And it's just beautiful. And I'm thinking, wow, the person who set that stone knew what they were doing. And so there's already a dialogue about the people who are working with their hands back then and me making my work about hands, because there are a few pieces in the show that actually are using hands as a form that talk about how we use our gesture and our bodies as a repository for who we are, how we leave evidence of our humanity through the things that we make. Oh, sure, we can do it through the things that we say or the things that we write, but the things that we make embody our stories, that objects hold our stories. That's what museums essentially do. It's they try and mine those stories and the objects in their holdings.
Are there pieces in loose strands and tight knots, when you see them next to your pieces, strike you more than others?
Well, there's some of them that are these really sort of wonderful, kind of whimsical and more straightforward connections. There's a piece that I call Pearls of Wisdom, and it's made out of my hair and the kind of hair that I have naturally felts. And that means that, think a dreadlock. A dreadlock is felted hair, but in this case, felted into balls and then strung with some silver from Ethiopia in a two-stranded pearl necklace.
Right, right.
And the object that's next to it is a beautiful freshwater pearl bracelet with the clasp, and the clasp has hair in it that is interwoven, European hair that is interwoven. And so Pearls of Wisdom, and then literally a pearl bracelet with hair. So in one sense, we're playing off the same kinds of notions. One of the pieces that struck me as sort of when I was in there that really made me think a little bit differently about my work is this, the head of a Buddha that's in one piece next to mine. That's a beaded piece of that's called Offering. And it's quite a small piece. It's only about 12 inches high. And it's these two hands sort of in the gesture of palms out with a bowl in between that's beaded. And it's called Offer. And the way that the curator writes about that is, you know, the sort of disembodied part of the head as a symbol of Buddhism, and the disembodied parts of the body and hands as a symbol of the self, as well as this nice interplay. But I kept looking at the sort of knots on the Buddha's head.
Right.
And I was thinking, wow, that looks so much like this other piece that's just in another case by itself that's called Springy Pear. And it reminds me of a hairstyle that I used to have as a kid, where you sort of tied your hair into these little, now people would call them bantu knots. These, you sort of thread wrap your hair and tie it, curl it back on itself. And I was thinking, huh, that's kind of an Afro-Abe on a Buddha head. but I started making these interesting connections.
How did you come up with, where did you begin with hair? I mean, how did this medium become your medium?
Again, it really came from the idea of thinking about, a lot of craft artists get very defensive, saying, you know, doing this art and craft debate, which I'm actually not particularly interested in. And I realize that a fair amount of that has to do with my homage to my grandmother, who was a tailor, and my grandfather. These are both on my mother's side. My grandmother was a tailor. My grandfather was a furniture maker. She made the money, though, because you need a new dress and a new suit far more often than you need a new dresser.
Exactly.
Especially if you make one right the first time.
And so, yeah, right.
And he was really a fine woodworker. And so I belong already, I've let you know that I belong to this tradition of craft makers, and I feel very strongly about that. And yet the question of where, you know, what is the first textile form is what led me to the idea of hairdressing. Now, how did I get interested in textiles to begin with?
Right.
I could blame that on my grandmother, who taught me how to sew and taught me how to thread a needle in a magical way. I mean, that I can't explain on the air, but really in a way that looks like a magic trick, and it works every time. But the I got interested in textiles because, again, of this idea of ubiquity. So, and listeners, you'll just have to trust me on this, but Mark and I are here in this room, and we are both wearing clothes. So,
yes, we are.
trust me, we're both wearing clothes. What I mean to imply by that is that there is one thing that we're always, always in contact with, and that's clothing. And so there is an understanding of textiles, an understanding of how they feel, the itchiness of wool, the mm-hmm. stretchiness of a sweater. I mean, there are all these things that we understand, like what a sweater smells, what a wool sweater smells like when it gets wet. It smells like a wet dog. Everybody knows
right?
Why it smells like a wet dog, okay, maybe you have to get a degree to figure out why protein fibers smell that way when they get wet. But the point is
they do,
and we all know that. And so, again, it becomes about that language that people, a shared language that people can understand. So grandmother, sort of an homage to her hands being re-embodied in my own, but also trying to use a language that is ubiquitous so that people are drawn into the artwork, not shut out from it. I want a 3-year-old to understand my work, and I want someone with 7 PhDs to have something to hold and see and be challenged by as well. If I can do that, that's a successful piece.
You use your own hair.
I do.
You don't use other people's hair.
I do sometimes use other people's hair. Yeah. The first piece I made out of hair was by a friend of mine who is happens to be biracial, so she grows hair very, very, very quickly. And so she would wear her hair in dreadlocks, and then it would grow, and she'd decide she didn't want them, and she'd cut them off. And she didn't grow up with these notions of you when you get rid of your hair, you should dispose right. of it properly. So she just gave it to me, and I said, oh, this is terrific. And a piece that I made was is in the show, made out of her hair, and it's called Hair Wreath, and it's borrowing from this Victorian tradition of Victorian hair wreaths. And what people used to do was take straight European hair and make it into these beautiful, beautiful flowers. Beautiful flowers, and they would make them sort of as these friendship wreaths or to memorialize someone who had passed away. And everyone would make a little flower out of their hair. This one's made with dreadlocks, so it looks more like branches. Mm. And unfortunately, they didn't have a Victorian hair wreath in the Walters collection.
But so you didn't put that piece in.
So well, no, the piece is in, but its counterpart, its European
counterpart is not in.
So we were talking about, you know, how quickly hair grows mm-hmm. just a moment ago. And so there is one piece in the exhibition that there are a couple pieces in the exhibition that are photographs. And some of them are more clearly, more evidently photographs than others. But there is this one piece that whenever I have shown it, I have always caught someone touching the artwork. One of the things about hair is that it does sort of measure our lives in a way. And you know, to take us to the muses, there's Lachesis who literally takes the thread of life and measures people's lives out. And so our hair does that in the same way. The beauty of dreadlocks is that they have all of the hair that has grown and actually become disembodied, felted, you know, dreadlocked to the hair that you're currently growing. And I thought, wow, this is a dreadlock can really measure your life in this way. It has your old hair and your new hair connected. And I thought, well, it would be really wonderful to make a piece that would represent how long one's hair would be if it never stopped growing, if it was always connected. In other words, a dreadlock that potentially was started at birth and finished at the end of life. How long would that be? And I calculated, because the average, our hair, everybody's hair, on average grows about 5 inches a year. Some people's more, some people a little less, but about 5 inches a year. And so doing that, I realized that if you live to 90-some years, that would be about 30 feet and a little longer. And so I made a digital image of a dreadlock that is about 30 feet long. And that's in the exhibition. And because it's a really good print, it honestly looks like hair. And this is the piece I always catch people getting really close to to touch because it's an image.
Right.
I mean, you can tell it's an image because not all 30 feet is splayed out. Part of it is rolled up. But still, people, it looks so three-dimensional. Thank God for technology.
And I was about to say, but so also, besides the physical craft work you do, you also work in digital work and you work in video. You combine these mediums as you work in your original medium.
Oh, sure. But the other, you know, when I'm doing that photograph is a photograph of hair. It's a scan of hair. It's not a digitally scanned image for the purpose of being digitally scanned. It's serving the purpose of the being about the subject matter.
No, but I mean, the way you constantly mix the mediums. I mean, a lot of artists, when they put their exhibits up, I mean, it's their exhibit, whether it's a painting or something that they've sculpted or something you've woven with hair. But you adding these other visual mediums to your medium is what I'm saying.
I guess that's true. Because before we were saying that, you know, why use hair? And I really was talking about the meaning in the medium. And then, you know, what meaning do I have in a photograph? I can't really speak about it that way, except that I couldn't make a 30-foot long dreadlock except to do it digitally. So I'm using, you know, the...
And you make your videos as well.
Yes, and I make my videos as well with help from other people. You know, I have someone who helps me with editing that sort of thing as well. But I think one of the wonderful things about being an artist in this time period is that we have all of these different media that we can use and we can express our ideas in so many different ways if we're willing just to learn a little bit.
It's been wonderful, Sonia Clark. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Mark. My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. We hope you'll consider making a donation to us to help us continue to bring you these podcasts. Just go to our website and click on Donate. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. And thanks to Clean Cuts Music and Sound Design for studio space. To hear more and learn more, visit us on the web at www.centerforemergingmedia.com. And for the Center for Emerging Media, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Give me down to there.